This podcast is free and it's accessible to everyone thanks to support from listeners like you. If you value this show, please consider supporting its production by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute to give, and you'll be helping to support the production of this podcast. Make a donation at kuow.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thanks.
This is Chris Morgan. People are in the wild for all kinds of reasons. Where's my water?
Give me my water.
That's a really good Chris Morgan impersonation.
It's terrible.
So are we ready to go?
I think we're ready to go.
All right. So we wanted to do something a little different on this bonus episode of The Wild. We have an interview of
Jim, Jim, we should probably introduce ourselves.
Good point. I'm Jim Gates. I am the editor of The Wild. And who are you?
And I'm Matt Martin. I'm the producer.
All right, we got that out of the way. All right, so anyway, Chris interviewed two documentary filmmakers about filming penguins in Antarctica, Jeff Wilson and Mark Smith. And we wanted to play an uncut version of this interview, just to give you a sense of how the podcast sausage is made.
Yeah, a penguin sausage, if you will.
Yuck. Anyway, so in that same spirit, we wanted to kind of share how this interview came to be. And then on the morning of the taping, we had a bit of an issue.
Yeah, a little bit of an issue.
You want to tell us about that, Matt?
So this was a real logistical nightmare to get this interview put together because Mark Smith and Jeff Wilson, they live in the UK, and so we had to find a studio there for them to talk to us here in America. And, you know, getting everyone's schedules together, and we finally got it set, and I triple and quadruple checked the time difference. We were going to have to be early in the morning for their afternoon, and we had it all set. And we were ready for early the next morning.
So everything's set. It's perfect. It's all good to go.
Good to go.
Right.
And then I wake up in the morning. I'm brushing my teeth. And then I get this ding on my phone. And it's a message from Mark Smith. And he's saying, hey, we're in the studio waiting for you guys to connect.
So they're an hour early.
And I go into panic mode. I'm freaking out because I don't know, like, if we miss this opportunity, I don't know if we're going to have another one to get both of these guys into a studio again to do this interview. So I start making phone calls. I call you, I call Chris, tell him to wake up the engineer. And I'm like running down to the studio, and Jeff and Mark were great. They just went and got some coffee and waited for us to get our game together. And then about 45 minutes later, everyone's in the studio. We get it going. And luckily, I think we got a really good conversation. And you know what the problem was, Jim?
What?
Damn daylight savings. The UK switches their clocks a week before we do in America.
That's just wrong.
It is wrong.
Backwards.
Yeah. So my takeaway is that we just need to get rid of daylight savings across the globe.
I'm with you on that.
But it was a little stressful that morning.
It's kind of like a duck calm on a pond, but underneath the water is just frantically paddling away.
Yeah. And so that's what we wanted to do with this bonus episode. We wanted to give you guys a little example. You get this nice, polished podcast episode, but there's a lot happening behind the scenes to make that work.
So this is kind of like the behind the scenes interview with Mark Smith and Jeff Wilson.
So we'll start the interview right where Chris got connected to Mark and Jeff in the UK.
Could you increase the volume a little bit of their end, or who's controlling that? There's three studios involved here. It's a bit of a juggle, isn't it?
We should probably speak if you want to hear a better
hello.
Volume.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, that's great. That's much better. Thanks, okay. Guys. Yeah. Everything good with you guys? All good there?
We were just talking about how we really don't want to talk about bears, so let's get that out the way first.
What my introduction was going to be? Well, it's funny you should say that, Jeff, because my first line here is we met among the bears, didn't we? You know, I remember the first time you arrived on the beach there at Katmai and saw all those bears, Jeff. It's one of those moments, isn't it, when you see that for the first time?
It's an amazing thing, isn't it? You know, we have such a small industry as wildlife filmmakers, and virtually everybody who comes back from Katmai or that part of the world says it's got to be one of the top three wildlife experiences. And then we all kind of brush it off because we've all had amazing wildlife experiences. And then you arrive and you get it. It's amazing. You know, that kind of proximity to those animals is, and just the wildness of the place is mind blowing. And it sits with you, you know, to this day, I think.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And I've got so much. I saw a clip the other day, Mark, of you with a bear, that bear walking right behind you along the riverbank there.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
I remember you filmed it right up to the last minute and then just turned around and your eyes like saucers kind of thing. It's a startling place to be, isn't it? It was really good to meet with you guys there. But, you know, bears are one thing. And, you know, no road access to that area, float plane access only, you know. But some of the places you guys have been and worked, it makes that place seem like a city park almost, you know. I just wanted to touch on a very famous clip that almost everyone has seen, and the sequence in Planet Earth of the snow leopard chasing its prey down that vertical wall mm-hmm. off a cliff. And that was you guys that captured that. You know, just one example of one of the extreme places that you've worked and what you came away with. That was an amazing thing to see.
Yeah, it was an incredible. It's one of those boys' own adventures that you never really forget. And coincidentally, we were just with Nissar, who was the guy who helped us with the logistics. We were just having lunch with him just before this. So, yeah, we were just reminiscing about the whole thing. And it was one of those trips which, you know, kind of is a major kind of landmark in your life, really, because it was one of the ones that everything just came together with a lot of luck and a lot of planning, but a lot of luck as well.
You often, that was, you know, it's such a cliche in our industry for things to happen at the last minute, but that was genuinely one of the times when we were failing miserably right up until the last minute. And then this amazing, amazing mother and cub popped out of the cliff face and sort of offered themselves to us, which was just an extraordinary situation.
I think that's I think that genuinely is that sequence that started all the whole thing of, and on the last day we got lucky, so to say, because actually genuinely that did. We'd been filming for weeks, you know, with a lot of luck with the snow leopard, but we still hadn't got, you know, a hunt sequence, which we'd been sort of dreaming of all these scenarios where it might happen. And literally, we were supposed to be flying out on that day.
Didn't President Musharraf kind of seconded our helicopter, uh-huh. I think is what we were told, right? And so yeah. There was a helicopter due to come and get us,
right?
The President of Pakistan decided it. He needed to use it, and so we had nowhere to go, so we just went back to where we saw the snow leopards last, and Mark got the magic after that. But it was, yeah, complete luck.
Oh, that's it. That is a great story. So experiences like that sort of readied you for the next extreme thing that you were to take on. And you know, another one of my favorite behind the scenes clips ever is you guys in Frozen Planet, you know, that's narrated by Sir David Attenborough, where you're describing how you filmed this sequence and this colony of Adelie penguins. Where were you there? Can you set that scene for us, you know, and why this species, Adelie penguins? Just kind of bring us into that spot with you.
So we were obviously making a series about the polar regions, and you know, we have really fortunate access to American Antarctica, which really means flying into McMurdo Base from New Zealand. And what McMurdo Base gives you is an ability to sort of shotgun out from their base of logistics into some amazing wildlife experiences. And we had teams who were going off and filming emperor penguins, and teams who were going off and filming underwater. And Mark and I think probably drew the short straw because no one else wanted to do it, and they sent us to the Adelie penguin colony, which is, you know, everybody, it was an extraordinary, I don't know if you remember, Mark, but people would look at us when we told them that we were going to this place called Cape Crozier, which mm-hmm. is this fantastically famous place in polar expedition kind of literature, because Scott had sent a team of scientists there to collect some eggs, some emperor penguin eggs, and that formed a part of a story called The Worst Journey in the World. So in literature, it's a very famous place. But when you arrive in McMurdo, people look at you and they go, you're going to Crozier. Okay, good luck with that.
And, right. And like we might not see you again.
Yeah, I just don't think it's a place that people volunteer to go. And then us, we kind of naively did. And paid the price afterwards.
and you were there for on that project 4 months, was it, filming
on and off? Yeah, we were there for like 4 months. We had a break in the middle, but yeah, we were there for a long time.
And Mark, what were the conditions like there? How can you describe what life is like for a penguin or a filmmaker filming penguins in a place like that?
It's pretty bleak. I mean, the reason that people were laughing about Cape Crozier was that it's got a reputation for the strongest winds, and the reason the colony's there is because the winds are so strong they blow all snow and ice off the ground, so at least the penguins have bare rock to to nest on. So it's not surprising that it's a very windy place. And so we've got there, and it was it was a beautiful day. We got everything unpacked and thought, this is going to be a doddle. And it was literally within 24 hours, we went out and the wind started to get up and we got into one of the biggest storms, well, definitely the biggest storm I've ever been in. Winds up to 150 miles an hour and we were stuck in this cabin for 3-4 days. And we're literally sitting in there thinking the roof is going to come off this thing. We're going to die. All the equipment's going to be blown away. It was just an extraordinary experience. And we're thinking, how are the penguins going
to
manage?
Off to a fairly positive
start. Yeah, it was.
Bear in mind, neither of us had been to Antarctica.
That list of things.
We were literally had been thrown in the deep end at that point. So that is kind of an extraordinary baptism.
Oh, my goodness. So it was all new. And when you say, how many people were there and what was the structure you were living in?
Well, when we first arrived, it was just Mark and I and an assistant, a field assistant who was there.
Wow.
So, and then the scientists who joined us came about a month later, wasn't it? After
mm-hmm.
our first. So we spent our first month kind of exploring the whole thing on our own. We'd talked with the scientists at length before we'd gone on the shoot. I remember one of the things that someone had failed to explain to us is that, we'd intentionally arrived before the Adelies had come back to the continent of Antarctica, and someone had failed to explain to us that an Adelie colony is basically built on thousands and thousands and thousands of years of decaying dead penguins. And so I remember walking into the colony that first time,
mm-hmm.
and all you see, for as far as the eye can see, is basically penguin carcasses. And I can distinctly remember thinking, bloody hell, we've got this completely wrong. Someone's going to come and pick us up in 2 months. We won't have filmed a thing because all the penguins are dead. and how are we going to solve this one? Are we going to have to start animating carcasses or something like that to kind of make ourselves look better? But it's a shocking thing because it is literally the substrate of a penguin colony is just dead.
It's just thousands of years of mummified penguins because nothing really decays there. It just gets, it's sort of frozen into the ground.
Wow. And then the penguins arrived when? At what point did you start seeing them come back?
So they're pretty faithful to around about October 15th. And that's what we'd sort of taken away from our conversations with the scientists. And I remember we had our big storm and there weren't many penguins around. And then the storm finished after 3 or 4 days and we went down and suddenly they were kind of just arriving, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming out across the sea ice. And so they were pretty on time. So that sort of time between the 15th and the 22nd of October is when they start flooding in. And that has to do with daylight length, I think, really, more than anything else.
Yeah. I see. And it's just, you see a penguin come over the horizon, there's one that turns into how big is his colony eventually?
Well, it gets up to 500,000. I mean, it's the now, it wasn't at the time, but it is now the largest Adelie penguin colony on the planet.
Wow.
You get 500,000 penguins plus there, 250,000 breeding pairs.
It's pretty impressive because, I mean, you're up, the colony is from sea level up this slope. And so when you're up the slope, you get a look out over the sea ice. And when you look out, the actual open sea to start with is maybe, 2 miles further out from the shore. And so you're looking, you're scanning the horizon. Eventually, you'll see these little dots coming, thousands of little dots coming towards you. And coming out, it's very heat hazy there as well. So you'll see them sort of emerging out of the heat haze coming towards you, and you realise that's them all, charging back.
And of course, when they start arriving, then the defining thing about an Adelie penguin colony is just chaos. I mean, it's full of dead penguins because that's where they, not many of them make it through the season, but it suddenly ends up being, I remember, Mark, you talking about it like being a war zone. It goes from being a very placid, kind of cold, beautiful place to this just chaotic war zone that you then have to try and make a film in.
Certainly towards the end of the season.
And war zone in terms of what? Competition between them?
Yeah, I mean,
Or just the mayhem.
Well, everything's dying. It's for the skuas, for instance, there's these birds, the skuas, that predate the chicks. By January, February, the temperature's gone up, so it's above freezing. So all the frozen mud is now liquid mud. All the mummified penguins that were underfoot are now floating around in this mud. The skuas are killing anything they can. So there's basically a mixture of blood and mud and penguin poo all over the place, and you're wading around in the stuff. And that mixed in with the noise of the colony, the constant noise of the colony, it's most extraordinarily oppressive place to be after a while. It's fine, you know, for a few days, it's amazing. But after, you know, 3 months of it, I literally would go down. I'd be there for an hour, and I'd have to walk away up the hill to get to hear myself think. It definitely had its moments.
It's so special for that reason, not having any human influence in that particular colony, you know, in that place. We were talking about it earlier. This, you know, that there aren't any human noises, and so your entire stimuli, auditory stimuli, is all coming from the natural world, which is an amazing thing. And there was a sound recordist who came down as part of that project who pointed out that this is a kind of place where the sound hasn't changed since Scott and his team were there 100 years ago. There's no overflights from passing jets. You know, you don't hear the sound of generators or cars or anything. It's just exactly the same sound as it has been for millennia. And that's an incredible thing. But like Mark says, when it's 500,000 penguins screaming at you and then you start hearing them, a couple of them say your name after a couple of, you know, they're going, Jeff! Jeff, Jeff! And you're like, who the hell said that?
You know, that's definitely true. That starts to play on your mind.
Yeah.
It really does. I heard exactly the same thing.
Yeah. What, Jeff or Mark?
Mark.
Did you kind of... Jeff, I know that you've got this sort of obsession with early explorers. I can relate because I'm the same, you know, and Scott and Shackleton, and we've talked about them. Did you feel like you were channeling those people when you're in a place like this, you know, because it is a place that's not changed since they were there?
I think it's not as much a channeling them as just being humbled by the fact that these guys were going through something. You know, of course, the story that was written about the expedition to Cape Crozier where we were working was called The Worst Journey in the World. And it was because they went through this enormous trial and tribulation to get there. And admittedly, they went in winter and we were in spring. But, you know, we got there in an hour's long helicopter ride, and it took them 2.5 weeks of marching with sleds to get to the place where we were, and in that time it was so cold their teeth were shattering, they lost their tents, you know, all for in the name of science. And so I mean the whole thing is completely humbling, you know, the fact that we were kind of living in the lap of luxury comparatively to what those guys were doing 100 years ago. But
amazing, amazing. Well, yeah, you're very humble about it, Jeff. I know you weren't chattering and losing teeth, but it sounds like it was quite... So let's talk for a minute about... So you're living basically in a shipping container, it looked like to me, up the hill from the penguins, right? And what was your... We'll come back to the penguin stuff in a minute because I want you to outline that for us, where we are, why they're there, what this phenomena is. But back to sort of your daily routine and your eating and sleeping, and I have a list here: eating, sleeping, crapping and bathing.
What did your routine consist of? In our time.
We tried to hold off the crapping. It's too painful to get outside. The toilet was interesting, actually. The toilet was basically a cupboard attached to the outside of the, effectively, the hut. And so you had to go outside and open this thing. It was shaped like an upright coffin, or a bit like a rocket, sort of pointy at one end. And most weathers it was all right. But then, you know, when there was a storm blowing, it really felt like the whole thing was about to take off. So you really, you know, it kind of speeded everything up quite well.
I don't know, I had performance anxiety when the wind was knocking at the door. Yeah, it was hard to squeeze one out.
Mm. That's great. Anyway,
that was the other list?
I love it. I love how quickly it comes around to toilets when you're talking to Brits. You know, it's like.
But you know, the extraordinary thing about, I mean, awesome. So Antarctica is governed by some very well thought out, very serious rules. So all of that excrement that we were generating, we have to take it with us. You know, it's not as if you're just doing what you would do in most parts of the world, is, you know, going into a hole and burying it at the end. You have to put everything in a bucket and carry it out with you afterwards. So luckily, obviously, wow, it's cold enough for it all to freeze, so otherwise it could get really heinous. But this is kind of amazing thing that you think at the end of it, you're taking absolutely everything with you. Every ounce of urine, every little bit of poo that you've generated is all coming with you. So it's an extraordinary logistics.
Right, the extreme version of leave no trace.
Well, exactly, right? Exactly that.
And when you're in this little shack, it looked like a little shipping container for months or weeks on end, just two of you, maybe three of you. How are you managing to stay sane? You hinted already that you had these moments of fleeting insanity, but how did you stay focused and together?
Good question.
We tried cooking, but that didn't really. I mean, we tried cooking lots of things, and they all ended up tasting fairly similar, regardless of what the ingredients were. That kept us going for a little while.
We played games with the. You remember, we played games with the cereal packets.
Yes, every because all of the food is American branded food. So if you're thinking things like Aunt Jemima's, syrup and I don't know, what's the guy on the front of the Kellogg's?
Oh, Frosties. Quaker Oats. I don't know what he was called.
Yeah, Quaker Oats. He's Mr. Quaker.
Yeah, anyway, we used to get them down and they'd have little parties with them.
Yeah, I think we'd talk to each other, channeling it through the branded faces of American foodstuffs.
That's
perfectly sane.
And by this time, you guys have spent a lot of time together, and you got to know each other. There's no place like that to get to know each other quicker, is there? And were the things that drove you crazy about each other? I mean, you must know each other so well at this point, but were the things that were like, God, I wish Mark would stop doing that, or whenever Jeff does that, or
I'm sure she closed the toilet
knitting.
Door.
I started knitting.
I wish you'd stopped knitting.
I was terrible at knitting. I started knitting just to try and take my mind off, being around. The same person all the time, so I could concentrate on that and not have to make conversation. But I was knitting a hat. I found it really difficult to remember how many, when you're going around, when you're knitting the hat, and you've got to remember each one, so you're trying to make it smaller as you go up. And I just couldn't do that. So in the end, that drove me absolutely mad as well, so I had to stop.
So it ended up being more of a neck.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can see you've done the same thing. Yeah.
The good thing about Mark is that if you leave him to his own devices, he becomes so pissed off with himself that it's impossible for him to get pissed off with you to the same level. So the thing is to just stay quiet, let him go through his cycle, and then let him come out the other side.
We're not really answering the question.
Perfect work partner.
Do you know? I tell you what. I think, Mark, correct me if you think I'm wrong, but we tend to quite often split up in the colony so that we weren't in each other's presence.
Yes.
At least towards the end, quite so that when we came back at the end of the day, we actually had something to talk about.
Yeah.
In terms of what we would.
Yeah. What did you see? Penguin.
Yeah. God, me too.
Yeah.
But I think that at least gave us a little bit of something to talk about. When we eventually came back to the hut, and were trapped in there for days on end.
Yeah, yeah. So were the circumstances, because you guys were just filming the Disney Nature film as well, and were the circumstances similar as they were during the filming of Frozen Planet?
Yeah, so very similar, yeah. In fact, it was quite interesting because... one of the most petrifying things I found about being there before was once you'd experienced, we were talking about that storm and that wind. I remember very clearly the sound of that wind before it hit us, which was like a squadron of 747 jets in the distance. It was like unmistakably, awful. And at that stage, I didn't know what it was. Once that storm had, you'd been through that storm, you sort of always remembered that sound. So when we went back the second time, I was always on the lookout for, if you're down in the colony, which was maybe three or four miles away, I was always particularly sensitive listening for that sound, because if that storm had hit when we were down in the colony, there's no way you would have got back. You'd definitely have died out there. And so when I was down there, I sort of felt a little bit nervous the whole time. And I do remember being down there once. We had four people there with us on our team. And we'd been out on the sea ice and we came back in. And I was chatting with her and she said, did you hear that? And I was like, what? She said, it sounded like something like a squadron of jets. And I was just like, oh, my God. Right, quick, everyone, pack up. I just went in full panic mode and sort of yelled across at Jeff, like, let's get out of here. And we packed it as fast as we could and legged it up the hill, but got caught in it. Mm. And We got back. We were literally crawling on the ground to get back up there.
I think even though we'd experienced it before, we hadn't got caught out in it on the first time round. And this time round, we were right on the edge, weren't we? And I remember getting up to the hut this time round and just being so physically exhausted. You know that kind of exhaustion you get where you're inadvertently making groaning noises when you're breathing? It was that level of exhaustion, and it was battling against these winds for what the journey normally takes, 45 minutes, doesn't it? And we probably it took us a couple of hours to get up that slope, through those winds.
Wow.
It was truly amazing.
I do remember that clip of you, Mark, pouring your thermos of tea, and the tea was just flying horizontally across.
Well, this was all, in a way, this
none of it ended up in your cup because of the 130 mile an hour wind. It was crazy to watch.
Yeah. That second storm we're talking about was almost more impressive in that we got into the hut, and at that point there were some people from McMurdo, the main base there, so what they call the carps, the joiners who come out and mend stuff, and they were putting up another building. They'd come out with all their kit, and their kit is brought out in a what is effectively the same size as a shipping container, made of solid wood, and they have everything there, and all their supplies, all the stuff that they need, they have in there, and it's slung under a helicopter and brought out. And for the duration that they're there, they get all their stuff out of it. And I was stood in this hut after we made it back to the hut, and at the corner of my eye, I saw something go past the window, and looked out the window, and that container had blown off and was making its way down the slope, and it blew about a mile and a half down this slope and came to rest at the bottom, and that was all their kit. So I don't know how much that stuff weighed.
They thought it was like somewhere between 800 and 1,000 pounds in a box got picked up by this wind and thrown down the slope. It was pretty extraordinary.
Are you kidding? That puts it into perspective.
Yep.
I remember that that clip of you, Mark, saying, I'm surprised the rocks aren't blowing. And then at that very moment, a rock blew.
Well, it's exactly that thing, yes. It's sort of once you, I mean, to keep going on about it, once you've sort of experienced that, it makes you worried about in other parts of the world. You're never quite sure what can actually happen in a wind that strong.
You know that, I mean, the way that cup of tea experiment came about was that one of the things that, again, is particular to that part of Antarctica is that when you have these really high winds, it can often be a high pressure day in that there's no cloud forms around and there's very little snow on the ground. So actually being able to visualize wind is a very, very difficult thing. There are no trees, there are no bushes, there's no buildings that can kind of show that they're being blown around by wind. So we were trying to figure out on that particular day how to communicate to people back home quite how strong the wind was, because if you just pointed a camera out the window, it looked like just a normal kind of cold, sunny Antarctic day. But, it didn't really reflect how strong that storm was.
You know, when these two words pop into my head.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.
Had this fortitude and resilience that you guys had to have, and then the fortitude and resilience of these penguins. Let's switch a little bit to the penguins. You've described this almost like a death zone, but it's almost a place of rebirth at the same time. It's a curious mix, isn't it? Can you explain why these penguins are there and when they're there and what they're doing? Can you give, and just in a nutshell, guys, just sort of explain what's the ecology going on there? Why are they there? What are they doing? And then we'll get into more questions about the penguins specifically.
I mean, so Adelie penguins are they come back to land, to the mainland of Antarctica to breed, and they do that over a 4-month period, and that's between the months of October and February. And in that really short period of time, they've got to do everything. They've got to build a nest, they've got to meet a mate, they've got to lay eggs, they've got to incubate those eggs, get them to hatch, rear their chicks, and then get them everybody out of the colony by February, by which time the weather starts changing and the sea ice starts building again. So they've got a very, very, very intense period of time in which to kind of do their entire breeding life cycle. And because it's so short, that drives pretty much everything in an Adelie penguin's life during those months, you know. So that's why they're so competitive. That's why they come together in huge numbers. They've just got to get through this breeding period as quickly as they possibly can. And so our time there was really mirroring, you know, both for Frozen Planet and for the latest feature that we've been doing. It was mirroring that period of time for the Adelie's life cycle.
And then 500,000 of them arrive, these screaming penguins, just down the hill from your container shack. And you go out daily to film them. And when they first arrived, what are they doing when they first arrive there? They just start to gather and huddle together against the elements? What is it you're filming when they first get there, and how does that
Well, then, first of all, the males arrive back first, and they arrive back to sort of claim their territory. And so they're there for a week or so beforehand, and they're just displaying to themselves, and they're building the nest, and they're collecting, you know, little pebbles and stones, and defending their little 2 feet around that nest. And so at that stage, it's all quite gentle and nice, and they're displaying rather beautifully on their nest. And then after a week, the females come back, and then it all kicks off a bit, because then there's a fair bit of disputes going on, and there's males who don't have females or whose females have died, and so they start roaming around, and they're trying to get another female, and so at that point there's a huge amount of fighting going on, and it can be incredibly violent. They'll fight to the death, and the best position in those colonies is sort of in the middle. So because if they're in the middle, they're further away from the skuas who are trying to predate the chicks. So ideally, you'd find a female and get a nest in the middle. And so to get to that position, you know, you have to fight. So that's when a lot of the action happens, and so that's kind of the point at which everything kicks off.
It's, you know, when you talk about 500,000 of them, and I've read there's, what, perhaps 8 million in total worldwide in Antarctica of this species, the Adelie penguin. You think, oh, must be a life of plenty. They're doing great. But it sounds like hell for a penguin there, what you're describing. It sounds like it's a difficult place to make a sweet story out of, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is. I think it's pretty...
death zone and fighting and competition for mating and trying to stay alive at the end of the day.
It's brutal.
That must have been a tough thing to tell a story in a sweet way when it is obviously such a tough place to be a bird.
I think it says quite a lot about Adelies that they don't aggregate outside of their breeding season, you know. I mean, we always look at they do come together in small groups, but they very intentionally don't kind of step on each other's toes like they do in the colony for the other 8 months of the year that they're not in the breeding colony. So, you know, that says a lot about kind of the nature of an Adelie penguin. You know, we always what you have at Cape Crozier is extraordinary juxtaposition of emperor penguins, because there's a small emperor penguin colony there, and you really get to understand the difference between an Adelie and an emperor. Hmm. And we always thought that kind of the emperors are like stoner penguins, right? They just sit there and they're kind of curious and easygoing, and, you know, they'll come up and say hello, but everyone's pretty calm. And I think it's mainly because they're fairly bird-brained, you know, they're not much as going on between the eyes in an emperor penguin. But an Adelie penguin, conversely, is kind of like a super over-caffeinated penguin. And these guys are on a mission, and they just are, you know, they're bashing the hell out of each other, they're bashing the hell out of us, that they, you know, they are literally on a mission, and no one's going to stop them. You imagine it's kind of like, imagine standing in a crowd of 500,000 Joe Pesci's from Goodfellas. It's kind of like that, and they go completely nuts. And so, yeah, I mean, it's like we said before, it's complete chaos.
Well, we saw it when the emperor penguin colony sort of morphed its way. This emperor penguin colony starts off in these ice cliffs about 4 miles across the ice from where the Adelie penguin colony is. And through the season, it sort of came out onto the sea ice and kept moving like this sort of amoeba across the ice. And at one point, it was quite close to the Adelie penguin colony. And so it was directly in a line with the Adelie penguins coming back from the sea to their colony. And the Adelies would come into the emperor penguin colony. And this was at the point where the chicks, the emperor penguins had big, fluffy chicks that were probably twice to three times the size of the Adelie penguins. And the Adelies would just come and rest in the colony. And then after a while, they'd start picking fights with the emperor penguin chicks. And they'd walk up to them and literally bounce into them and look up at them, at the emperor penguin chicks, sort of towering above them. And the emperor penguin chicks were just like, what are you doing? And the Adelie penguin would just not give up. It would bounce into it and literally pushing it until the emperor penguin chick turned and ran. And then the Adelie penguin would chase it. And then other Adelie penguins would join in.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think, but you know, joking aside, that's what makes Adelies such an amazing subject for filming, is that they have this abundance of character that you can see, you know, even between individuals in the colony, you can see the ones that are slightly more relaxed or slightly more pissed off or slightly more kind of ambitious. It seems extraordinary to say that, but there are distinct differences in the ways that all of those, you know, 500,000 or 250,000 breeding pairs approach life, which is really the definition of character, and that what's kind of makes them an interesting subject for filming.
Mm.
Yeah, and a whole host of characters, like you say, each with a different personality. Yeah. And when you go in, you know, how much are you arriving with a story? So for example, in the Disney nature film, I love the title of it, Steve, by the way, it's about Steve the penguin. How much of that is sort of, how much do you arrive with a story in mind versus letting Steve determine what that story is, you know? I mean, there must have been loads of directions that you could have gone in and used, but the penguins help design the story while you're there live almost.
We had the fortune of obviously being there before, so we kind of knew what to expect and what to get, you know, what was going to happen to us. But I think in any filmmaking, regardless of whether it's penguins or not, you have to approach all of these subjects with a slightly zen attitude of letting Mother Nature drive and being there to kind of take pictures along the way, you know. And I think anybody who tries to overscript an experience will find themselves coming unstuck. So I think the best balance really is to go with an idea of the kind of story that you want to tell, but to be totally open to, you know, serendipity. And that for me is the reason that I do my job, is allowing serendipity to take over at the important moment and just making sure that you're prepared to capture that.
I love it. And so when you have those moments and you get back to your shack, and I know you guys, you've probably got a bottle of scotch to celebrate certain moments with there, you know, what were some of those moments? What were like your high five moments of, oh my God, can you believe that just happened?
I think certainly one was, I was talking about when the males are building their nests out of rocks, and there's some very funny behavior goes on. We were really lucky to be able to film some of that, which is mostly the males have to, they're building the nest and they have to walk off to find stones, and they may have to walk, you know, 20-30 meters to go and find a good collection of stones to, and then walk back to the nest. And then, but some of the penguins have cleverly worked out that why bother to walk 20-30 meters when you can just steal stones from the nest next door. And so it's absolutely hilarious to watch that happening, because the poor penguin who's walking, you know, 20 metres, 30 metres back and forth is totally oblivious to the penguin that just nips literally 2 feet away to steal the stones. And, you know, it's such a great bit of behaviour that we managed to get it almost all in one with very little editing needed, because the birds are so close together. You're able to film it very, very easily. And it basically told the story itself. And I think that was definitely one of those moments when we got back and it was just, yes, that is just funny. In any language, that's a very funny thing.
I think, Mark's being incredibly humble about this as well, Chris. I mean, I think the thing about that particular sequence is just the I'm not one for bigging up Mark, but that stone stealing is happening a lot, but to get the perfect combination of an animal coming in and out of frame and the other one still being in the background and looking over its shoulder and coming in and having it all happen in real time without the need for an edit is an extraordinary, you know, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Mark, but it didn't happen on the first day, did it? It's kind of like, mm-hmm. that's just persistence and persistence and persistence to be observing and watching and turning over and failing time and time again to get the perfect shot. But you can't better what Mark achieved in that particular sequence. That is the perfect sequence.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I agree.
it's amazing to me how popular penguins are. You know, you mentioned that the worst journey in the world, Jeff, earlier on, and I came across an awesome quote by one of the writers on that expedition in 1910, and he said, they are extraordinarily like children, these little people of the Antarctic world, either like children or like old men, full of their own importance.
Yeah, it's just, that's really true.
These just sound like lovely characters that everyone can kind of relate to and see a bit of a human being in, right? Did they remind you of humans and their personality traits?
I think that's kind of the thing that we kind of, you know, obviously we're there to capture behavior, but you want people to understand, you know, at least I do, I want people to understand that penguins are more than just cute and funny. And I think, you know, seeing the fighting and the stone stealing and you know, just some of the things that make them have faults, which in a bizarre way makes them more relatable. I mean, I think personally I find animals that are put on a pedestal and given a whole bunch of wonder completely unrelatable. It's the ones that are slightly angry or have bad days or get pissed off that make them feel much more in connection with human life, you know, much more on a continuum with our characters. And I think Adelies are perfect for that because you can see that happening.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that's why people are drawn to them? That, I mean, this species that most people in their lives will never lay eyes on for real, you know, because they live in these very isolated places, but they can still relate to. What's that all about? What is that anthropomorphic kind of relationship there? Can you talk a bit more about that?
I think the fact that you can, you know, I mean, penguins are. Completely expressionless, which allows us to project our own emotions on them. You know, they don't have eyebrows, they don't have forward-facing eyes, and so they in that way they don't have what we would conceive as expressions. However, they do have a sort of physical comedy to them, which allows us to project our own kind of thoughts and our own mind into their being, and whether that's the right thing to do or not is not always correct, but at the same time I think they do have this range of characters that allows us to kind of embellish, you know, individuals in the way that we have done in the past.
Yeah. I don't struggle with that anymore. We went through that a little bit with the bear show, didn't we? You know, it's like, how much are we going to impose our human behavior traits and actions on these bears? And you can't help but do it. And I think it's because we do share some of those traits. It's quite interesting, you know, whether we're like penguins or penguins are like us, or same with bears. It's difficult not to go there, isn't it? And I don't think there is a problem going there, you know, making these animals
there are certain emotions,
seem a little human, because it makes them accessible.
There's certain character traits which are universal, aren't they? I think when it comes down to children and raising young, then it's easy to see, to make those links between, you know, between humans, between bears, between penguins. I mean, there's, you know, that all of us are sort of, you know, that's a primary aim, protecting their young, and that links everything, I think.
I think you're right, Chris, and that there's
everyone can
no
relate
shame
to that.
In anthropomorphism anymore. I think, you know, anybody who spends a significant amount of time with animals will understand that human emotions are not a uniquely human thing. You know, we're all on a continuum, and that continuum includes many of the species that Mark and I have gone out to film. And I think just by pure observation, regardless of whether you're capturing them on camera or not, you know, you get to see things that are recognizable as emotion and as characters, and then I don't think there's any shame in broadcasting that.
Right. So You guys have spent so much time in these wild, faraway places that most people never go to, and then you get to share what you've seen with the rest of the world in these incredible, incredible films. How, Mark, I'll start with you. How does that make you feel when you see your work on a screen where you've been through that real raw experience and now it's come to the world?
It's difficult sometimes to quite see it as anyone else does, I think. It's only after maybe 10 years have passed that you can actually look at something and see it how everyone else sees it. I think from the point of view of a cameraman, it's very difficult to see what you filmed without also remembering all the stuff which you didn't film and missed. So initially it's right. You're out there and you've seen so much amazing stuff that for whatever reason you weren't able to film.
It's a painful experience initially,
it's a painful experience, and then over time you forget all that stuff and you see it for what it is. But yeah, so it's a difficult one to answer that. Even if it's, it's great, it's difficult to see what everyone else is saying about it. Hopefully, after a time, you do.
And what about you, Jeff?
Yeah, when Mark and I finish working together, then I go back and watch the same footage over and over and over again, probably 1,000 times. And so I think the greatest tool in any filmmaking armory is actually the editor, who comes at it from a fresh perspective. I think if Mark and I were asked to then make an Adeli film after spending 4 months amongst them, it would probably be the darkest Adeli film ever made, and then we probably would be pushing our own experiences way into the zone of affecting how the film would be. Whereas what the editor does is, he kind of comes at it completely fresh and completely objectively and looks at our work and says, okay, well, this looks interesting and this looks fun. And he works with us to kind of shape that into something which can help people understand the experience without the lens that we've taken away from it. And I think that's the benefit of not having to wait 10 years, like Mark says, to kind of see it for what it is, that's what the editor does. But I think, ultimately for me personally, just every time that we put a bit of the natural world on screen, and regardless of the amount of effort that's put into it, is a complete privilege.
And your films have been seen by countless millions, I dare say maybe even billions of people at this point. And what do you hope to achieve by these films? What do you hope people take away? And in the case of Penguins in particular, what do you want someone to feel, do, experience during and after that film?
Well, personally, I think that you have to hope that the audience feels some empathy with those penguins and, understands the struggles that they've gone through, so that when they, people read in the news about, overfishing or, problems in the Ross Sea where the penguins are feeding, is that they're already sensitive to what lives there. And it's not just some disembodied bit of news, but there may be, they can relate to the fact, oh, that's where those penguins, are living. And if it's, if there's a problem there, then these penguins are going to be less well off. And so hopefully, it all adds up bit by bit to making people more sensitive, more aware. For me, that if you can achieve that, then you've achieved something.
And Jeff, you described it as a privilege, but do you see it as an obligation to get the word out as well?
Do you know, I have always felt that. I come from a family of conservationists, but more and more lately, I kind of really believe or feel strongly that it's really important for us as wildlife filmmakers in the blue chip sphere, is what we call this kind of pure natural history that we do, to remind people that, humans are not the center of the world in most of the planet. We're so good as humans to put ourselves at the center of every picture, and in fact there is so much going on in particularly in the natural world that has absolutely nothing to do with us. And I think it's important really to kind of reestablish that balance occasionally to kind of tell stories that just have nothing to do with any human whatsoever and kind of represent the natural world. And that, and to me, that's the truest form of documentary that you could possibly hope for, is just kind of reminding people that there are things happening out there that have absolutely nothing to do with us. And although we have an effect on it, there are places, and, you know, Kate Crozier is maybe one of the best examples, is that that whole life cycle goes on regardless of any human influence at all. And year in, year out without, you know, for millennia, I think it's really important to kind of break people away from the drama of their daily lives and remind them that there's something else going on in the world that doesn't involve them. And, that's my main drive these days.
Mm-hmm. You must get kind of emotionally attached to your subject. I mean, something as adorable as a penguin character named Steve, for example, you can't come away from that untouched, and it must sit with you for a long time.
I think I think you go through various stages of love and hate, particularly with Adele's. You know, you come out of that experience completely shattered, completely.
Same with
exhausted.
You and Mark as well, probably, right?
And you have to be really honest about it. It's kind of a heinous place to work. You know, it's great for the first couple of weeks, and then after that, it becomes pretty difficult until you've got the end in sight. But when you get to the end, and I think the little bit of diary writing that I did, Mark's much better at diary writing than I am, but I remember writing, saying, you know, that the Herculean effort that these animals are going through in order to get through their breeding season is really admirable, you know, and we were knackered and fed up and ready to go simply because we didn't belong there. And these guys were, you know, these Adelies are nailing it, you know, and have been doing it for a long time, and that's something to be really in awe of.
I agree, because I think when you come back and, you know, these making ofs come out and everyone goes, oh, isn't that great, what a hard time you had, and aren't you tough for doing all that stuff, and then, you know, that's one tiny little blip in time, you know, and those penguins are doing that every, you know, minute of their lives for I don't know how many years. And you think, well, that's, you know, it's really not very much compared to what they've got to put up with.
It's so much tougher than we actually managed to put on screen as well. I mean, there was so often you'd see, you know, they're getting attacked by leopard seals in the latter part of their season. And, you know, these leopard seals are monsters. They're 8 foot long and, you know, they eat penguins for breakfast, literally. And they, you know, they're taking chomps at these penguins, and the penguins are getting away with half a head, you know, missing. And then they would sit on the beach. You remember, there'd be an Adelie penguin sitting with half its head, you know, falling off, and it'd sit on the beach and you'd walk past it for the best part of 4 or 5 days. And then on the fifth day, you'd walk past it and it would just get up and walk up the hill as if nothing had happened. And, you know, that's exactly how tough they are. They, you know, you've got to pay respect to an animal like that.
You make it sound like Tarantino would make a great film in this place.
I think Tarantino might have been a penguin scientist in his former life.
Right. Let me ask you this then. When you come back from these experiences after being away from home for so long, that re-immersion must be quite difficult and strange, hey? I mean, can you even have a normal conversation in a pub anymore? I mean, Mark, what does that feel like, that re-entry?
Well, all I can say is that I think a very good strategy is to have some kind of halfway house where when you come back, that you can, if you can spend a day somewhere else before you sort of revisit the family, then it's a hell of a lot better than if you just go straight back in there. Because you're right, it is quite tough, especially because you've just got used to your way of life, you know, and you go back and you really have to sort of try and slot back into the family and expected to do the washing up and all the things that you're expected to do. And you really, your head is still dealing with 500,000 penguins and death. you're a bit of a basket case. And so quite often I'll just end up going back home, and I definitely remember one occasion I just went back and I just sat on the couch at home for an entire day looking out the window, just wondering what had happened. And so, yeah, mentally it's an interesting thing to deal with.
And with that, Jeff, when you come back, I mean, you've got a lot of time to think about things in these wild places, and then you come back and you might not have that processing time. But when you do, what do these places make you think about our world or the sort of bigger, broader perspective? I know that's it's a big question.
Do you know, I mean, I kind of... The profound... I think we're in the fortunate minority in that it's almost the reverse, where these wild places allow you to kind of have perspective on your own life. You know, you disappear for a month and you don't have the pressures that we all have in our daily lives, you know, in our normal adult, you know, world. And you go out and you get a perspective on everything, and then you come back and you find it a lot easier to deal with. So I actually find it restorative rather than a problem when I come back. You know, I come back a better person, but my wife might say differently. But it does give you just a little bit more of a calm approach to you know, the problems which we all face, which end up being incredibly minor when you look at them from 1,000 miles away.
That's a really lovely perspective. It must just be a treat to sit on a toilet that's not going to blow away for you guys.
Actually, I installed fans in my toilet after I got back.
That's not because of that, though.
Just to make you feel at home. let me ask you, and I'm watching the time here, guys, so we may come back to a couple of thoughts, so let's leave some time for that. I wanted to ask you, though, I know you guys don't like blowing each other's trumpets, but let's just do it for a second. What is it about this? What's this nugget of magic that works between you guys, you know? Because I know it's a pretty special relationship. I've seen it in person. So what is it? How would you describe
it? I'm
kind
of waiting for Mark to retire.
Jeff, how would you describe it?
I don't know. I think it's just we worked each other out pretty early on, and it's a tolerance. I don't think either of us have got quirks that are that we can't overcome. That may be something to it. I don't know. What do you think, Mark?
We don't talk to each other very much. That helps.
That's the secret. Secret to any good relationship: just don't communicate.
I think we're both pretty tolerant people. I think, yeah. I mean, we're both pretty tolerant. We both enjoy being out in these amazing places, I think, and that's about it.
I think we also both have the same outlook in terms of the attitude to work when we're in the field. I think we both know what a privilege it is to be there, and we like taking, you know, risks that are manageable and kind of pushing ourselves and pushing the boundary and trying to figure out what happens if we walk around the next corner. And I think both of us have that in us to kind of look over the next corner or over the next mountain or behind the next iceberg and think, oh, I wonder what's there. And we just go there, and sometimes it pays off.
It's true. I remember that very much with that snow leopard trip. That I remember that feeling. I think you had the same thing of, it's like, we're in this extraordinary place, like I said, a boys on adventure, and we're getting paid for it, and we're seeing these amazing animals. I just think this, you know, the excitement, it's like being a sort of 12-year-old boy for a job.
Mm. And of course, no one's there to kind of check your decision-making, so it's just the two of us. So we do go off on these crazy things and you know, just to try and see, because no one else has seen what is around that corner, and we go off and... Like I said, sometimes it does pay off, and sometimes we just end up looking like complete fools and knackering ourselves out.
I love it. And having the right company in moments like that is very important, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, you've seen it, Chris, haven't you? You've seen it on the bear thing, you know, when you were out there with us as well. That's, you know, it's you've got to get on well with people, and you need the right mixture.
I think that's what we found in you guys, yeah, as exactly. Well, is that we kind of, it's exciting. It's not just about animals. You know, our job is, we get to meet fantastic people, and we get to meet people with enthusiasm. And I think both Mark and I are better listeners than we are talkers, which is why we tend to enjoy meeting people, because God knows that you can talk, Chris. And, you know, that's why we like to be in your company.
I thought there was a compliment yes. coming, but no, never mind.
I didn't say that you could talk interestingly. I just said that you could talk.
I remember, Chris, I think one of the few times I've ever seen Jeff angry was on that bear trip that we all did together. Remember, we were doing aerials. Jeff wanted us to do aerials. He had the Cineflex, yeah. And we were walking down that river. He wanted us to walk up a river looking very manly. Do you remember that? Together.
I do remember.
Yeah,
that
and we're walking
well.
Down
there. Yes, it was a struggle
walking through this river. It was incredibly difficult to do, and we're thinking, "What the heck is he want us to do this for?" And then, as a joke, to explode the manly myth, I thought, why don't we just, you and me, hold hands? And so...
Oh, that's right.
And as you and I linked hands, like a loving couple, in the middle of the river as we're walking down, that was the crucial point in Jeff's shot, where it was all looking absolutely perfect.
It was only a $5,000 helicopter shot, wasn't it?
Yeah. I should have known. I should have picked some different people.
Yeah, the one time Jeff Wilson got angry.
It doesn't happen often. It normally only happens with people as well.
Guys, I got to say, thanks for letting us into your corner of the wild. It's been really lovely catching up with you and hearing your stories and I can't wait to hear what people think about this. Thank you.
Chris. Thanks, Chris. Great talking to you again.
At Soundside, we bring you news and conversation rooted in the Pacific Northwest. Hi, I'm Libby Denkman. I think of my job hosting Soundside as, number one, asking tough questions of powerful people, the questions you, KUOW listeners, want answered. And two, bringing you a daily slice of the fascinating, confounding, and often goofy side of life in Washington State. Join me for Soundside at noon and 8 p.m. on KUOW or anytime on the Soundside podcast.